Well, good morning. Good to see everybody here this morning. Glad to have everybody out here for another Sunday to worship our Lord. Unfortunately, we're riding, or my family personally is riding in a little bit of a limited capacity. Genevieve has been kind of fighting a fever and a cough for the past couple of days, and so I planned this morning on just coming by myself and leaving the kids, but Thomas was very insistent that Thomas really wanted to come to church. You know, and as a father, you want to encourage those things. You want to encourage your children to love coming to church, to love the Lord. And so, with the false bravado of a young father, I figured I can take care of my son during services. And you may have noticed that when you came in, I looked like a wounded gazelle on the Serengeti that realized he's bitten off more than he can chew, because I got to stand up here for the next 30 minutes and I can't watch my son. And so, thankfully, Tracy is willing to watch my son as the buffoon up here stands here without his son. And so, thankful for a family that is able to support us even when we sometimes make decisions that make it more difficult for ourselves. We've been speaking the past couple of weeks. We're coming to a conclusion today on our series, both about the apostles and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I have to admit, it has been incredibly rewarding for me personally to be going through these activities and to be studying these things and to be spending time in the gospel. And so I thought the only real appropriate way to conclude this series was to look at the center point of the gospel, the center point of the apostles' lives, and that is the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. But I wanted to look at the crucifixion just a little bit differently than sometimes we most often do. I hope by now we have all heard the story of the crucifixion multiple times. We talk about it a lot, and we should. It is one of the central tenets of the Bible, is this moment where God in flesh is sacrificed for the sins of mankind. And this story is relayed with obviously central importance in all four of the Gospels. But one of the things that I want to talk about today is that each of the Gospels tells this event with slight different twist. And I think sometimes we can casually read these things and kind of dismiss those differences. Okay, well, that's just, you know, some random tidbit that Luke has thrown in there, or just a little fact that Matthew recorded. But one of the things that's important to remember is that when we're reading the Word of God, this is not just the haphazard recollections of somebody who was there. This is not only careful and diligently prepared from a mortal standpoint, but God has also edited and God has also been a part of this writing process. So every detail that is included in these stories is there for a reason. So what I want to do today is I actually want to look at Mark's account of the crucifixion. And we're actually going to look at some of the peripheral details. We're actually not going to take a lot of time to talk about the crucifixion itself. And instead, we're going to kind of look at some of the surrounding characters that Mark includes in his gospel narrative. And these characters, for some reason, were important enough for both Mark and the Lord to include for us to read about today. So what we want to do today is we want to learn, okay, what is Mark specifically trying to emphasize in his account of the gospel? And we're hopefully going to be able to pick up some of the skills where we can read these literary accounts and try to pick up on some of the details and some of the emphasis that these authors are giving. So we're going to start in Mark chapter 14. Last week we talked about the failure of the apostles, and we covered a little bit of the material we're going to talk about today. We went over the details of Judas's betrayal. We talked about the failure of the apostles in Gethsemane. We talked about Peter's denial. We're going to see some of these same events taking place here in Mark's account, whereas last week we mostly used Matthew. And so we start in the Garden of Gethsemane. We know the story of what's going on here. This is shortly after Jesus has instituted the Lord's Supper. This is after Jesus has gone before the Lord in prayer. The apostles have been sleeping, and Jesus has woken them up and said, now the time is at hand. And so picking up in verse 43 of Mark 14, Mark records for us, immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up accompanied by a crowd with swords and clubs, who were from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now he who was betraying him had given them a signal, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him and lead him away under guard. After coming, Judas immediately went to him, saying, Rabbi, and kissed him. They laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as you would against a robber? Every day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But this has taken place to fulfill the scriptures. And they all left him and fled. Just as a brief aside, I think it's incredible here. We're going to see this a couple of times in Mark's account. How utterly calm Jesus is in the midst of all of this. Now, we've seen a glimpse of Jesus' emotion. That Jesus is very emotional at this time. Jesus is dealing with a lot of stress and a lot of concern. But he exudes this aura of being in control. That when this mob is coming to arrest him, he doesn't freak out. He doesn't lose his cool. He just says, it's kind of funny you're coming out here as if I'm going to resist. He says, you could have done this at any point in time. But I tell you why it's happening this way is because God wills it to happen this way. And he peacefully goes with them. And notice it says they all left him and fled. And then Mark includes a very odd detail here. In verse 51, a young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him. But he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. And they led Jesus away to the high priest. All right, so this is a weird inclusion here. And Mark is the only one of the three synoptic gospels, and John doesn't mention this either. Mark is the only one to mention this young man. So what's going on here? There's been a couple of different theories posited. One is that this might have been Mark himself. That this might have been Mark including this detail to kind of stamp his approval that, yes, I was there. I witnessed some of these things. I was there, and I can even promise you, because I've got a really embarrassing anecdote about it. That might be one way. Now, there's some conflict with that, because some of the first and second century authors note that they did not believe Mark had ever met Jesus. So there's some conflict of that, so that might be a possible answer. But there's something going on here. There's a reason Mark's including this. So we're not going to get the answer yet. But keep in mind that there's a young man in a linen sheet over his naked body. They seize him, and he pulls free of the linen sheet, escapes naked. The clear thing we can see is that this young man symbolizes all those who have followed Christ. They specifically say he is a follower of Jesus. This young man is intended to be read as a disciple. And in this moment, his shame has been laid bare. Literally, he is without cover for his shame. His nakedness is apparent to everyone, and he is fleeing in utter terror. So this young man, whoever he may have been, represents all of the disciples. Because he is a very stark visual image of what all the disciples were going through. That all of them had their shame laid bare as they abandoned the Lord and fled for selfish pursuit of their own life rather than their Lord. So this young man, whoever he is clearly symbolizing something because he's never given a name. So he's a symbol of the disciples that have fled, and his linen sheet is left behind. So let's keep that in mind. We don't get the answer quite yet, but we're going to see later in the narrative, I think, why Mark is including this passage. The rest of the text continues on, and we've read through these texts before, so we're not going to get too much into detail, but Jesus is dragged before the high priest. And again, Mark is so interesting in how he records this. Mark specifically says in verse 55 that the chief priest and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build a made without hands. But not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Of the Blessed One. Do you see what's going on here? The high priest have no charge to bring against him. They're trying desperately to find something, but even by their own standards, they can't find a consistent testimony. They cannot find anybody who will witness with any accuracy what's going on with this man that's worthy of putting him to death. Remember, the chief priests and scribes have already pre-concluded what they want. They want to put him to death, but they cannot find a reason to do so. And so the chief priest is now even asking Jesus, not so subtly, did you say these things? Did you claim to be the Christ? Trying to get something on him. And notice that Jesus actually responds. And Jesus said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven. Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Jesus is the one who advances the trial. Jesus says, okay, I'll give you what you want. I'm the Son of Man. You know what I've already preached. I'm the Son of Man, and you're going to see me sitting at the right hand of God. So Jesus, again, is completely in control of this situation. Again, very different compared to what's going on with his disciples. Jesus exudes calm assurance of what's about to happen. Right after this, Peter gives his famous denial. He denies the Lord three times, as we talked about last week. And then the scene cuts to the next morning. And it talks about how the next morning, the chief priest with the elders took Jesus and they took him over to Pilate, who was the governor of Judea at this time. And Pilate is clearly kind of caught off guard by all of this. He doesn't seem to know very well who this Jesus is. He seems to have been kind of unaware of everything that's been going on. And so he's rather surprised by the veracity or by the viciousness of the claims being made against him. And he, from what we can tell, doesn't seem to really be interested in killing Jesus. Doesn't really seem to think there's any reason for it. He seems to kind of get the idea that the Jews are up to something. He's not sure what's going on, but he doesn't really see a reason to kill Jesus. And so the text picks up in verse 6. Now at the feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. The man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionist who had committed murder in the insurrection. The crowd went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? For he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead. Answering again, Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with him whom you call the king of the Jews? They shouted back, crucify him. But Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, crucify him. Wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them. And after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. Now this is all very odd. We have no recording of this tradition up until now, and this would seem kind of a minor episode. Now, this is recorded in the Gospels as well, that Barabbas was released. And so there is a hint of trying to convey what's going on here. But what's interesting is that each of the Gospels calls Barabbas something different. One of the accounts emphasizes that he's a thief. One of the Gospels emphasizes that he's a murderer. One of them emphasizes he's a rebel. But I think it's interesting that Mark emphasizes that this man is an insurrectionist and a murderer. Now, what do we know about those two terms from the Bible? Well, insurrection, if you're not familiar with that word, is a rebellion. And this happened a lot under Rome, that the Jews were constantly trying to rebel against Rome. And so Barabbas had rebelled against the legal authorities and was now in prison for it. And in the course of that rebellion, he had committed murder. Now, why is Mark saying these specific things? In Deuteronomy 9, verse 6 and 7, Moses very pointedly links the idea of rebellion with the idea of sin. And in Deuteronomy 9 and verse 6, Moses says, know then, it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stubborn people. Excuse me. Boy, I just completely lost where I was. There we go. It did. Okay, I was trying to figure out, I was like, where did all the words go? But yeah, my page turned when I sneezed. Know then it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stubborn people. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you left in the land of Egypt until you arrived at this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. Moses very clearly is indicating that he believes this idea of rebelling against the Lord, rejecting the Lord's authority, that is sin. And that's what sin is a rebellion against God. So when Mark is calling this man an insurrectionist, a rebellious individual, he's saying historically what he is, but he's also making a point here that this man rebelled against not Rome, but against God. And he also calls him a murderer. Well, we know that in Romans chapter 6 and verse 23, that Paul says the wages of sin is death. Could we not say that sin is the taking of our own life? That it is the surrender of the life that God has given us? It is the rejection of the life giver. And so by choosing sin, we have chosen death. We've chosen to give our own life instead of taking the life that God has given for us. And so I believe when Barabbas is identified as an insurrectionist murderer, Barabbas is meant to be read as a parallel of us. We were the murderous insurrectionist. Not because we had murdered someone else, but because we had murdered ourselves. In our rebellion against God, we were losing our own life. And Barabbas, I think anybody in that crowd would have agreed Barabbas needed to be put to death. That would have been just. But instead, Jesus was put to death on Barabbas' behalf. Notice the parallel that's going on here. I believe it's a very intentional one, that Barabbas here is a clear image of us, the ones who deserve death for our murderous insurrection. And yet Jesus is put in our place. The text continues on in verse 16. And says that the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium. And they called together the whole Roman cohort. They dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him and they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him. After they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him and put his own garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. This is a very brief passage, but it attests how awful Jesus was treated. In verse 15, it mentioned that he had been scourged, which by itself was a punishment that often led to the death of the individual being scourged, because they were whipped with leather cords, sometimes wrapped with bone or stone. And then he is beaten mercilessly, a crown of thorns driven into his head, and a purple robe being put upon the now laid open back. It's not explicitly said, but Jesus would have been a mess at this point. And so Jesus is now being forced to carry his own cross. That was the traditional punishment of the Romans, is that they would lead the crucified through the streets of the city in shame and make him carry his own cross to the place of punishment. But it says in verse 21 that they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Now again, this is an odd detail. Now, actually, all three of the Synoptic Gospels include this detail, that this Simon of Cyrene was to come and bear his cross. Cyrene, if you don't know, was a city in Libya. That's why most depictions of Simon are of an African individual, because likely he was. And so he had to have been a Jew because he was visiting over the Passover. So for some reason, this Libyan Jew was in the country, and he must have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he is called upon to bear the cross of Jesus. And we don't know exactly how this would have worked. We don't know if he took one part of the cross while Jesus bore the cross horizontal piece. We don't know if perhaps he helped Jesus carry the cross from Mark's account. But Luke mentions specifically that he was behind Jesus. And this is an interesting image. One, because I think it emphasizes the idea of the humility of Christ. That this deity was willing to let a human help him. But I think it's also designed to call an image to mind. Mark doesn't record this, but for Luke 9:23, Jesus, in teaching the 5,000, said in verse 23 that if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. I believe Simon is being used here as another image. An image not of the rebellious disciple, not of the disciple who has fled in terror, not of the murderous insurrectionist, but of the follower of Jesus. That being a follower of Jesus is not about saving our own life. It's not about our sin. It's about whether we're willing to take up the cross and follow Jesus. And by all indications, Simon must have responded in some capacity. Mark is the only one to record the names of Simon's son, the father of Alexander and Rufus. These names aren't mentioned in any of the other Gospels. And this might seem like, again, a very odd detail to include. But if you look at Romans chapter 6 and verse 23, just real briefly. As is Paul's custom, Paul often ends his letters by greeting some of the people he knows in the churches that he is writing to. And remember, Paul in Romans has not been to Rome yet. So these people that he knows are people he has known before they had been dispersed from Jerusalem. And he says in verse 13, "Greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord, also his mother and mine." Now, it's always possible there's two different Rufuses, but an interesting detail here is that Mark's gospel is suggested by early church fathers to have been written specifically to the Christians in Rome, and specifically for the purpose of evangelizing in Rome. And so if he's writing to a Roman audience, do you think they might have known Rufus, the son of Simon? They certainly did by the time Paul had written the letter. And so is it possible that Mark is trying to point out here, if you want to know what happened with this story, go ask Rufus. Ask him about what happened to his dad. Simon might have even been there. So we don't get an indication of how Simon himself responded, but apparently he responded well enough that his sons were not just Christians, but they were good and faithful Christians. And Rufus's mother was considered by Paul to be like his own mother. So I think we see here that Simon was heavily impacted by what had occurred here. And in taking up the cross to follow Jesus, he not only did it in this moment, but I believe he did it in the rest of his life. And so we've seen here multiple characters that Mark is almost going through an evolution of these characters. He's talked about the disciple who has fled Jesus, who has abandoned Jesus. He's given us an illustration of what we really are in our hearts. We are murderous insurrectionists. And the only way that we can overcome this is by being like Simon, by taking up our cross and following Jesus. And the rest of the account concludes with the crucifixion of Jesus. And we know the terrible things that occur to him. We know the mockery that is given to him. We know his cries for his Lord. And we know that he is crucified and he is buried. And we could spend time, if we had, talking about some of the other minor characters. Joseph of Arimathea, I think, is worthy of a study all on his own. A prominent member of the council who gathered up courage and went in before Pilate. But what I want to conclude with is actually the first words of the resurrection of Mark chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might come and anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" Looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right, wearing a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He has risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him." This episode is recorded for us in all four Gospels. But Mark is the only one to use the term young man here. Most of the other Gospels talk about an angel or a messenger of God or two messengers of God in the tomb. But Mark says a young man. And it's interesting because this is the only two places in the Gospel of Mark where he uses the term young man. It's in Mark 14 with the young man in linen sheet, and now in Mark 16, the young man in the white robe. Now that's interesting. I believe Mark is trying to call us in a literary sense of this young man. Now, don't mistake me. I don't believe this is the same young man. I believe Mark is doing a literary device here more than relaying the young man in the garden was secretly an angel. But he's calling a literary attention that the young man has changed clothes. Well, where did the linen sheet go? We talked about Joseph of Arimathea. In verse 45, it says, "And ascertaining this from the centurion, Pilate granted the body to Joseph. Joseph brought a linen cloth, took him down, wrapped him in the linen cloth, and laid him in a tomb which has been hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb." Twice, Joseph buries him in a linen cloth, it is mentioned. Do you know the only other two times a linen cloth is mentioned? Mark 14, where a linen cloth is stripped from this young man. I believe Mark is literary. Again, not the same cloth. Don't get held up by that. In a literary sense, Mark is making the point that the shame of the fleeing disciple, the linen cloth, is now covering Jesus. That Jesus has taken on the shame and the reproach of his disciples and has been buried with it. So if the linen cloth, from a literary device point, is now covering Jesus, Where did the young man get a white robe? Well, again, the only other time that Mark mentions the word white in terms of clothing is in Mark chapter 9. Very briefly, this is our last passage. And it says in Mark chapter 9, during the transfiguration, in verse 2, that he was transfigured before them, and his garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth can whiten them. It's the only other time a white robe is mentioned. So Jesus has taken the linen cloth of shame and has been wrapped in it and has been buried in it. And now the young man who was shamed has been given a white robe, the same white robe from a literary sense of Jesus. Mark concludes his resurrection account, and it might look, if you look at Mark, it's kind of a depressing end, because it ends in Mark 8 in traditional manuscripts with them being afraid. But if you're reading from a literary sense, you know what's going on. The fleeing disciple has been redeemed. Jesus has taken the shame of the linen cloth and has granted his fleeing disciple a white robe of glory. And is this not what the resurrection account is all about? Is Christ taking the shame of a murderous insurrectionist and granting him the glory of his own radiance? It's pretty incredible, the literary devices that Mark is using here to speak theological truths. Because this is ultimately the message of the crucifixion. You were shameful. Your sin has made you shameful. But Jesus has taken away your shame and has given you a new appearance of glory and radiance. We're going to talk more in the second hour about the resurrection of Jesus and his appearing in radiance. But I want us to think about those things. How our cloth of linen shame has been redeemed for a white robe of glory. Thank you.